Hello, everyone. This is The Daily Occupation. My name's Anika. Let's get started. Today, I'm going to talk about upper extremity conditions. This is something that I needed to study a little bit more than some other areas just because it didn't come as natural to me. And I know everyone has their different strengths and areas of improvement. And this was one that I just needed to spend a little bit more time on. So I really wanted to make sure that I made a podcast to help those who maybe are struggling a little bit or just need some repetition and something to listen to just kind of help with remembering different upper extremity conditions. I will be having a separate podcast episode on splints coming up here soon. So keep an eye out for that. I do talk about a couple different splints in here in the sense of treatment areas for certain conditions, but I do go more in depth in a separate episode. So please be sure to check that one out. I would highly recommend listening to both of the upper extremity and splint episodes kind of at least either right after each other or pretty soon after. So then they can just kind of be in your head and flow together. I do have a PDF on my website. Be sure to check out thedailyoccupation.wixsite.com/resources to check on that PDF and follow along and add notes if necessary to the episode on the upper extremity conditions. And hopefully that can be helpful in getting a little bit of an idea of some of the main keywords that I think are important to remembering for practice, but also for the exam. So to start, I'm going to talk about complex regional pain syndrome. This is pretty much going to happen after two different possibilities. So we have two types. We have type one, which develops after a noxious stimulus or kind of painful, something that happens. And then type two is going to be after a nerve injury. So what really happens after either of these events or injuries is that the pain or the symptoms are going to happen at a higher degree than maybe they should in the sense of what the actual injury is, or they will be prolonged after the injury has begun to already heal and should no longer be eliciting so many symptoms or pain. This is going to pretty much cause a lot of different symptoms, and that can be very, very difficult for the patients in engaging in their daily activities and their routines, and it can be very difficult for them to be comfortable. And we as OTs have a lot of different ways that we can try and assist them in getting back the function in their arm, decreasing the sensitivity, all of that. So the symptoms that people with CRPS are going to be experiencing, they'll usually be experiencing allodynia, which is pretty much just sensation that's misinterpreted as pain. So it's not pain that they're actually having, but their brain is misinterpreting it. They also can have hyperalgia, which is pretty much an increased response to painful stimuli, so kind of like hypersensitivity. And then we have hyperpathia. And that's going to pretty much be being pain that continues after the stimuli is removed. So after the nerve injury has begun to heal or after the noxious event has gone away, they are still going to be continuing to experience pain. They may also experience edema, contractures. They have bluish or red, shiny skin. They may have abnormal sweating and even some hair growth in certain cases, muscle spasms, decreased strength, and a low tolerance for activity. So overall, it's going to be weakness, swelling, sometimes some differences in their skin, and a lot of pain and hypersensitivity. So what we do as for treatment, really, there are a lot of different things that they can go through. There's a lot of different things that physicians can do for them, but that is something I'm not going to focus on as much because we will be seeing them and doing a lot of the same things regardless. And so a lot of what we're going to worry about is having gentle, pain-free, active range of motion, but for short periods of time. We are not going to do passive range of motion or any painful treatment. We want things to be comfortable for these individuals, and we want them to be them to initiate the movement, the active range of motion. We do not passively move their extremities because this could cause more pain, more sensitivity, etc. We also are going to do some stress loading activities. So stress loading activities is pretty much trying to find ways to kind of weight bear on their arm. And so that could be scrubbing the floor, carrying handbags that are heavy enough. Washing a car is a really great example. I really like scrubbing the floor while washing the car because it provides more than just the stress loading of the motion of washing something, but also there's the different stimuli and sensations that are coming along with the soap and the water and things like that. We will do pain control techniques. So this could be doing tens. We could also have some splinting. So normally what we'd start with splinting is we would do static splint, and then we would progress to a dynamic splint as tolerated to allow for more movement. Also, we can do some edema control techniques because edema is very common in individuals with CRPS. And so we will do, we'll have them elevate, we'll do some massage, active range of motion, contrast baths, compression. And lastly, we'll do some desensitization techniques. So fluidotherapy is really great for some desensitization with the corn husks floating around, blocked exercises, tendon gliding, joint protection, and of course, energy conservation to try and get them to have ways to try and conserve their energy and to prioritize what they're going to do for their activities and listen to their bodies and what they need to do depending on their pain levels. Okay, now we're going to go into flexor tendon repairs. So flexor tendon repairs there's a lot of different types of, there's the different zones, there's different pulleys, and there's different types of surgeries that can go depending on where the flexor tendon is ruptured or the pulley is compromised where they need to go in and surgically correct it. So it's kind of a very big umbrella term for just saying flexor tendon repair, and I understand. So I'm going to just quick kind of give some background about flexor tendons before going into the specifics of what we will do after a surgery. So flexor tendons, of course, they're going to pretty much include the flexor tendon superficialis and flexor digitorum profundus. And these are pretty much the tendons that are long and thin and in the hand and are going to run right under the tight pulley system. So if you remember from school, we've got the A1, A2, A3, A4, C1, C2, C3, C4 pulleys. So pulleys are pretty much found on the flexor side to prevent a bowstringing. So pretty much that is usually what happens, and usually it's the A1 pulley that is compromised, but that is not always the case. So if you kind of see those the terms, that can kind of help you know, okay, that's flexor tendon repair. So there are things to keep in mind. There's limited blood supply. So nutrition is provided mainly by synovial diffusion. And so pretty much with the limited blood supply, it means slower healing process. That's mostly the important thing to remember there. We also have nerve supply. The nerve supply for the flexor tendons is going to be medial, radial, and ulnar branches of the hand. So we have different zones. Zone 1 is from the fingertip to the center portion of the middle phalanx. Zone 2 is from the center portion of the middle phalanx to the distal palmar crease. This is called no man's land because for so long, doctors would avoid surgery here because it was very hard for it to be successful because it's difficult to do that without scarring surrounding the tissue to make it difficult for tendon gliding after surgery. However, they've overcome a lot of those barriers, are able to do it successfully nowadays with new techniques, but that's also just kind of the name that stuck with zone 2. Zone 3 is from the distal palmar crease to the transverse carpal ligament, so kind of like the middle of your palm. Zone 4 overlies the transverse carpal ligament. And then zone 5 extends beyond the level of the wrist. Okay? I don't expect you all to remember those things, but that's what kind of what I have there. Just to kind of keep in mind that there are a lot of different areas and things that can happen depending on the type of zone and the type of surgery that is being performed. So there are some complications that can occur. So there can be nerve involvement. Usually laceration to the nerves is kind of the most common. This is usually due to the mechanisms by which tendons are injured. So if you think of the palm of our hand, we're using our hand, we're holding things. Laceration is common for nerve involvement to occur. There can be edema that is going to be therapeutically controlled by us to help with the motion and pain and stiffness that patient would be experiencing. Pain is very common at the site of injury. That can also be, you know, can be impacting ADLs, and we can assess that through ADL checklists or looking at how people can perform their ADLs. And muscle actions can be affected. And so this can really cause impairments in flexion and deviation of the wrists and digits. So there are different protocols to keep in mind depending on your physician or the surgeon and what they want. And that this is something important to remember, because depending on the protocol will depend on how exactly you go about intervention. So the protocols, the most common are the Duren and Kleinert protocol, but I do have some others here that are found on a lot of MBCOT resources. So not as common, but just something to remember. So Kleinert is the one that is going to be active extension with passive flexion with traction. So the traction is going to usually be provided by rubber bands. So just remember that the rubber bands are going to be passively pulling the patient's hand into flexion, but they're able to actively extend. Now, if they had a flexor tendon repair, you know, we want, according to Kleinert, we keep the flexion with that passive traction to ensure that the tendons are able to heal properly before they are going to have any resistance or some sort of stress on them, to ensure that they heal before we remove that type of a splint. We have the Duren protocol. Really, the Duren protocol is looking at early passive range of motion. So that is mainly what Duren is going to hope for. So think of passive range of motion for Duren. Early active motion protocol. So this is really beginning within days of the surgery. This is just going to try and help preventing adhesions and promoting tendon gliding and excursion. We have the immobilization protocol, which is pretty much what you would think. It's pretty much to have the patients become have splints in the sense where they're immobilized to prevent rupture of the repair. And this is usually for patients who are unable to care for themselves. They don't have the cognitive capacity to ensure that they will be safe and not rupture their tendons post-op, or they are children and we are trying to ensure that the tendons do not rupture. And lastly, we have splinting, which this is pretty much just used to prevent a rupture, because the repaired tendon is at its weakest up to 10 to 12 days post-surgery. And splints are used in the Kleinert protocol and other protocols. So that's just something to think about. But splinting in itself is also a protocol in a more general term. But what we have to remember is that the tendon is weakest up to 10 to 12 days post-surgery. That can be really helpful in understanding some timelines, especially when it comes to some of the protocols. Okay. Now we're going to talk about some interventions. So obviously, depending on what you're what your protocol is from your surgeon. You will do these at specific times. But pretty much we're going to focus on exercises that are going to promote tendon excursion, preventing adhesions. We're going to use modalities. This could include heat to help with preparing the tissue for motion, and NMES to help with tendon excursion and activation. However, you need to make sure that the physicians clear the use of modalities. We want to have a home exercise program. That's very important. A lot of the times you'll be seeing people with tendon repairs, obviously, in the outpatient setting. So they will be not, you know, with you all the time. They're going to be at home. It's good for them to continue their exercises at home to ensure that they are getting what they need for the repair. Tendon glides are going to be used to promote excursion and preventing adhesion. Tendon glides are pretty much just like a sequence of movements that are going to promote the full tendon excursion and full active range of motion. So there's, I highly recommend if you want to visualize tendon glides, OT Miri has a video on what the tendon glides all look like, but you're pretty much going to have your hand completely with your fingers extended, and you're going to roll your fingers down into kind of a hook grasp, and then you're going to have kind of an intrinsic plus kind of, and then you're going to go into a full fist and then bring your thumb in as well. And so it's really working on every part of the motion to try and really help with preventing adhesions. But like I said, OT Miri has a video. Otherwise, I'm sure you could find other videos online if you need a visual of what tendon glides look like. Range of motion, of course, is very important. Strengthening is something that is very helpful, but we have to wait until the late phase of the repair. So usually 8 to 12 weeks after surgery, we can start strengthening, which will be very helpful in trying to ensure that the client can actually use their hand in daily activities, since, you know, 8 to 12 weeks is a long time to not really be using your hand, and we have to get back the strength. So normally we try and do all these things. If a client is not able to cognitively follow a protocol, the extremity is usually put in a cast, which is kind of like that immobilization protocol, and it's in a protected position, and that's going to be for 6 weeks. So just something to keep in mind if you're working with a patient or there's a problem on the exam and it talks about a client not being able to follow protocol. At the end of the day, movement is helpful, but if they can't follow protocol and are going to have the risk of rupturing the repair, we will do the immobilization for 6 weeks. Okay, now I'm going to go into nerve injuries and syndromes. So what I'm going to talk about here is there's going to be, most of the ones I'm going to talk about are ones that are the more commonly taught and discussed in classes, and that I think we're more commonly showing up in resources for the exam. So I'm just going to try and piggyback off of that and provide these definitions and symptoms and kind of what's going on and knowing how to address these syndromes and injuries. So first, we have a radial nerve injury. And with a radial nerve injury, the biggest thing we're going to see for symptoms is wrist drop and a possible lack of finger and thumb extension. So depending on if they have surgery or not, are different ways that we can address through intervention. So if they do not get surgery and it's a non-operative treatment, we are going to use a wrist cock-up splint with or without dynamic finger and thumb extension assist. We're going to do passive and active range of motion, isotonic strengthening exercises once the muscle is reinnervated. If they have operative treatment, so they've had an operation, we will use a static wrist extension splint at 30 degrees. And after 4 weeks, we're going to adjust the splint to 10 to 20 degrees extension. So to try and kind of counteract that wrist drop, we're going to have it at 30 degrees extension and then try to adjust it down because they've had surgery. And then we're going to go into radial tunnel syndrome. Radial tunnel syndrome is really the entrapment of the radial nerve in an area extending from the radial head to the supinator muscle. So what's really going to happen here is we're just going to have a burning pain down the lateral forearm. So for non-operative treatment, we're going to do a long arm splint. A long arm splint is pretty much going to have the arm positioned with the elbow flexed, the forearm supinated, and the wrist in neutral. We're going to massage or use TENS for pain management. We're going to do some pain-free range of motion, nerve glides, activity modification to avoid forceful wrist extension and supination. Because the supinator muscle, as you know, for supination is something where we've had some of the entrapment of the nerve. So we want to try and avoid that forceful movement for the healing process. Now for operative treatment, they've had surgery. We're going to still use the long arm splint. And just to remind you, elbow flexed, forearm supinated, and wrist in neutral. This will be done for 2 weeks. Then we'll do some passive and active pronation and supination, some hand strengthening exercises at 3 weeks, so a week after the splint has been discharged, and then resistive exercise at 6 weeks. Okay, now we're going to go into pronator syndrome. So pronator syndrome is the entrapment of the proximal median nerve between the heads of the pronator muscles. So pretty much the symptom is going to be deep pain in the proximal forearm with activity. So non-operative treatment, we're going to splint the elbow. So pretty much we're going to splint the elbow in 90 to 100 degrees flexion and keep the forearm in neutral. So we're going to use TENS, gentle prolonged stretching of supination and elbow, wrist, and finger extension, activity modification to avoid some repetitive forearm rotation, and prolonged elbow flexion. So we want to try and prevent them from pronating and supinating their arm too much because of the median nerve entrapped in the pronator muscle. And so that's what having the elbow splinted in flexion and the forearm in neutral will help for, but then we'll also do some other activities. Now, if they have an operation, we're going to do a half cast. We're going to do active range of motion of all upper extremity joints while wearing the cast. And then we're going to do some muscle strengthening at about 1 week. And then we can do full active range of motion by 8 weeks. Median nerve injury. Median nerve injury can pretty much just be the sensory loss in the index, middle, and radial side of the ring finger, loss of pinch, thumb opposition, index finger, MCP and PIP flexion, and decreased pronation. So there's a lot that the median nerve, as we know, innervates in the wrist, hand, everything. So what's going to happen is if they don't have surgery for non-operative treatment, we're going to do a static thenar web spacer splint, because what would happen with prolonged median nerve injury is apan deformity. And remember, apan deformity is kind of the thenar muscle is very atrophied, and it is very difficult for all of those motions that I said for what the symptoms would be for median nerve injury. So with operative treatment, we're going to have a dorsal wrist blocking splint worn for about 4 to 6 weeks. We're going to do active range of motion and passive range of motion in the splint for the digits and the thumb. And then we're going to do tendon glides, scar massage. And then at 6 weeks, we can discontinue the splint and then begin some more strengthening exercises. Okay, next we have cubital tunnel syndrome. So cubital tunnel, I know we talk about carpal tunnel, but there's cubital tunnel. So cubital tunnel is going to pretty much be caused by a proximal ulnar nerve compression at the elbow between the medial epicondyle and the olecranon process. So the cubital tunnel is in your elbow, carpal tunnel is in your wrist. So this is the second most common nerve compression of the upper extremity after carpal tunnel. So some symptoms that you will see a patient experiencing, they'll have decreased sensation in the little finger and the ulnar half of the ring finger, because it is the ulnar nerve. They'll have decreased grip and pinch strength because of weak interossei muscles, weak adductor pollicis muscles, and weak flexor carpi ulnaris muscles. So a lot of our pinch and our grip comes from, we really grip a lot with our fourth and fifth digits to really hold something. So without your fourth and fifth digits, if you try and hold something with just your three, your thumb and your first two digits, it's a lot more difficult to hold something very strongly compared to using your little finger and your ring finger. So it can be very difficult in the sense of occupations or work or anything that relates to grip and pinch. Causes of this, there's a lot of different things that can happen. Rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, a fracture or dislocation at the elbow. Alcohol abuse can even lead to this. Assembly line work with those repetitive movements, diabetes. There's a lot of things that can come into play with cubital tunnel syndrome, hence why it's the second most common nerve compression of the upper extremity. So one thing on knowing if they have cubital tunnel to know that versus something else possibly at the elbow is there's Tinel's sign. Tinel's sign is where you tap over the cubital tunnel and it's going to elicit symptoms. There's Frohman's sign. This is going to be flexion of the IP of the thumb when lateral pinch is attempted. So there's, you can tell that there's that occurring. Wartenberg's sign is where the fifth finger is held abducted from the fourth finger. Because as you know, ulnar nerve is going to go from half of the ring finger and then the pinky finger. And so if the pinky is going to be held abducted, you know that maybe there's some decreased innervation there. We've got also the elbow flexion test, which is going to involve holding the elbow in flexion for 5 minutes with the wrist in neutral to see if holding the elbow in flexion for that amount of time is going to elicit symptoms. So if they do not have surgery and we're doing non-operative treatment, we're going to worry about edema control, pain management, ulnar nerve gliding, proximal conditioning activities, posture, and ergonomic training, especially for those if it is related to work. We also will have them wear an elbow splint or positioning the elbow at 30 to 60 degrees flexion for 3 weeks. For post-operative treatment, so they've had an operation, there are two different phases of intervention that we can do. We have the protection phase, which is the first day after the operation, up to 3 weeks. The elbow is going to be splinted at 70 to 90 degrees flexion. We're going to worry about wound care because they just had a surgery, edema control, pain management, and active range of motion of uninvolved joints. And we're going to worry about one-handed ADL techniques because they're wearing that splint. The active phase is going to be 3+ weeks after the surgery. You're going to discontinue the elbow splint, and then you're going to add elbow active range of motion. So we're going to do pronation to supination, add wrist motion with elbow flexed, then extended. We're going to do ulnar nerve gliding and desensitization techniques. Now we're going to talk about carpal tunnel syndrome. This is the most common nerve compression of the upper extremity. This is pretty much just the entrapment of the median nerve as it courses through the carpal tunnel in your wrist. So symptoms is going to be numbness and tingling in the thumb, index, and middle fingers, especially at night, as well as diminished fine motor coordination. So causes, there are a lot, hence why it's the most common nerve compression. We've got tenosynovitis, cumulative trauma disorder, some fluid retention. So if you have fluid retention for pregnancy or endocrine functions, this can elicit carpal tunnel syndrome. So if you know anyone who started experience carpal tunnel after pregnancy, it can happen. It's not as rare as you think. Ganglion tumors, if you've heard of ganglion cysts on your people's hands, they can cause that because of the inflammation. Tumors, of course, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and other traumas like wrist fractures or dislocations. So for evaluation, we're going to do Tinel's sign, which is like we did for cubital tunnel, except for instead of tapping on the cubital in the cubital area of the elbow, we're going to tap on the median nerve at the wrist. That'll elicit symptoms. Phalen's test is holding the wrist in full extension for 1 minute to see if it increases symptoms or elicits symptoms or there's changes in sensation. The Moberg pickup test, which is a time test with small objects. And this is usually for children or adults who have cognitive impairment to test their median nerve function. And then, of course, the Semmes-Weinstein monofilament test to determine how much lack of sensation they have. Non-operative treatment. So for non-operative treatment, we're going to do carpal tunnel splint or a wrist cock-up splint at 0 to 10 degree wrist extension. Now you can do a prefabricated splint, which can be used if you're needing to adjust the wrist position as time goes on. We're going to complete nerve and tendon gliding exercises, activity modifications like handles, gel pads, padding on handles, client education for avoidance of certain postures and activities that aggravate the condition. So an example is wrist flexion or certain keyboarding postures. Some people have their wrists flexed too much or they're extended, and that can cause that irritation. Also postural retraining and proximal conditioning. Post-operative treatment. So usually for operation, they're going to have a carpal tunnel release or an endoscopic release. Some may not need therapy after this, but for more complicated or severe cases, we're going to engage in wound care and scar mobilization after the operation. We're going to do pain management. We're going to do some splinting only to the clients who sleep with their wrist flexed or who are going to be engaging in too much activity too soon after the surgery. And then we're also going to worry about active range of motion of the wrist, thumb, and fingers at about 1 to 2 days post-op. Nerve and tendon gliding exercises and strengthening activities are going to be at about 3 to 6 weeks. Okay, we have two more left. I know that this is very long and a lot of information like a fire hose, but hopefully this can be helpful in just another repetition of learning about these different diagnoses. So we have de Quervain syndrome. I personally have experience with de Quervain syndrome. I played tennis all the way up until college and into college. And so having a lot of those movements kind of elicited some of those, painful movements, that kind of micro trauma. So like I said, cumulative micro trauma is going to result in tenosynovitis of the thumb muscle tendon unit. So the thumb muscle tendon unit is going to include the abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis, along with the tendons in the first dorsal compartment of the wrist. So causes are forceful repetitive thumb abduction with wrist ulnar deviation, CMC osteoarthritis, scaphoid fracture, intersection syndrome, or radial nerve neuritis. People who are at higher risk, women who are aged 35 to 55, later in your pregnancy. So sometimes people, as we talked about before with carpal tunnel, people who become pregnant with that fluid retention can definitely have de Quervain's as well. Mothers of young children, that's why they call it mother's syndrome as well. So just to remember that it's thumb abduction and ulnar deviation. So think about picking up a child underneath their armpits as like a little baby infant. And that is why they call it mother's hand or mother's syndrome. Mother's thumb is also another one that they call it. So that's something. Otherwise, it's also people who engage in extensive keyboarding, playing the piano, needle point or knitting, and racket sports. Non-operative treatment options. A lot of the times, corticosteroid injections are options for them for pain. We usually use a forearm-based thumb spica splint. The wrist is going to be in neutral and the thumb is going to be radially abducted, and we're going to do that for about 3 weeks. We're going to worry about activity modification, avoiding grip. We're going to try and progress to a soft splint and engage in isometric exercises after about 3 weeks. We're going to talk about computer ergonomics, especially if that was a role in their diagnosis or something that they do very frequently, and strengthening activities. For operative treatment, we're going to, usually they're going to have a surgical release of the first dorsal compartment. So we're going to do a forearm-based thumb spica splint, just like in non-operative treatment. However, we're going to have the wrist at 20 degrees extension instead of neutral. And the thumb is going to also be radially abducted. And this is going to be for 3 weeks as well. We're going to do gentle range of motion and tender gliding exercises. Grip and pinch strengthening is going to occur at about 2 weeks. And we're going to talk about scar management and desensitization techniques as well. Lastly, I have claw deformity here. Claw deformity is usually distal due to distal ulnar nerve compression or a lesion at the wrist. Usually it's like in Guyon's canal. Has a hard time saying, yeah, Guyon's canal. So usually the causes is a carpal tunnel fracture, or not a carpal tunnel, sorry, a carpal fracture. So a wrist fracture at the Guyon's canal. You could have a ganglion cyst in that area, some neuritis or arthritis. Pretty much what's going to happen is you're going to have sensory loss of the little finger and the ulnar side of the ring finger. So pretty much where the ulnar nerve is going to innervate. Along with sensory loss as well to the dorsal side of the hand, which is going to be just proximal to Guyon's canal, and then loss of intrinsic ulnar innervated muscles, which is going to be interossei muscles and the adductor pollicis and the flexor and abductor digiti minimi. So there's also going to, of course, be motor loss due to the deformity. And what's going to happen here is that the MCPs are going to be hyperextended and the IPs are going to flex, and then the hand arches are flattened. Therefore, pinch strength is lost. For evaluation, we have Frohman's sign. Frohman's sign is the flexion of the IP of the thumb when lateral pinch is attempted. We've got Wartenberg's sign. The fifth finger is going to be held abducted from the fourth finger. And Jean's or Jean's sign, depending on how you pronounce it, hyperextension of the thumb MCP. And of course, we're going to do the Semmes-Weinstein monofilament test to look at the loss of sensation to ensure that it is actually through the whole innervation of the ulnar nerve, and that those are what is actually going to have that decreased sensation. For non-operative treatment, we've got ulnar nerve palsy or anti-claw splint. It kind of makes sense. Claw deformity, anti-claw splint. So if that can be helpful in remembering, that's pretty much going to have dynamic PIP extension and also to be used if needed to help if there's any PIP flexion contractures present. We're going to do some padded anti-vibration gloves during activity because the nerve could easily be irritated due to vibration. We're going to do some activity modification, so some certain types of handles, gel pads, things like that. Padding on handles for a certain vibratory equipment, like a lawnmower, for example, because of that nerve irritation. And of course, education of avoiding certain postures and activities that are pretty much going to aggravate the condition. And a big example of a posture or movement is going to be ulnar deviation with wrist flexion. Post-operative treatment, we have bulky dressing usually on the client for about 3 to 10 days. We're going to have them get placed in a dorsal blocking splint to maintain the wrist at 20 to 30 degrees flexion. The MCPs are going to be also blocked to 45 degrees extension to help protect the nerve repair. Now remember, in the typical claw deformity, the MCPs are hyperextended. So we're going to keep it slightly extended at that 45 degrees because we want the nerves to become nerve to be repaired. Because if we have it in too much in neutral or in flexion, that would put too much stress on the nerve repair, and it would probably not. It would probably rupture. So splints adjusted at about 3 to 6 weeks to try and increase that position of the wrist more into neutral from the flexion. And then at 6 weeks, we're going to discontinue the splint. So normally what we're going to do is at about the same time that the splint is discontinued, so at 6 weeks, we're also going to begin active range of motion of the wrist and hand. And then we're going to resume ADLs and begin muscle strengthening, work conditioning, and sensory reeducation at about 10 to 12 weeks. So that is what I have for upper extremities. I highly recommend if you have questions about certain evaluation terms, like the Frohman sign, Tinel's test, and Wartenberg sign. Those, for example, I highly recommend looking those up online to get a visual for what they are. I don't think those are as important in the sense of exam purposes. I think it's good to be kind of understanding of, especially for the more common ones. I think Phelan's test is very important for carpal tunnel, for example, and Tinel's is also important for cubital and carpal tunnel. I think it's important to think about like Finkelstein's test for De Quervain's. There's some things to think about for those. So visuals can be very helpful. I also recommend looking at other resources on these to try and get a little bit more of an idea. And if you want more visuals on the splints, I highly recommend looking them up for yourselves. But I do have a splint episode as well that I have a PDF on my website that also shows pictures of what each splint looks like, if that helps to give you a visual and the idea of kind of the position that the hand is placed in the sense for the certain condition. And it kind of can make sense once you know exactly what happened, especially if they had an operation for like a tendon repair or a nerve repair. It makes sense that we don't want to go completely in the opposite direction of how they were to ensure that we keep that integrity of the repair. So I know I already said this, but I'm just going to remind you in case you started in the middle or didn't remember, but I have a PDF on all of the conditions that I talked about in this episode on my website on the resources tab. Also, be sure to go on Facebook and search The Daily Occupation and request to join the Facebook group. So if you have questions or want to get more information about when new podcasts are coming out or new episodes are coming out or anything like that, please feel free to do so. Good luck with all of your study endeavors, and I am sure you all will be doing great on your exam when you take it. And thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I'm Anika, and this is The Daily Occupation.